Jurassic Park became a massive hit 25 years ago. Good dinosaur noises there. It was one of the biggest films Steven Spielberg ever made. Its animatronic dinosaurs and its use of animation were groundbreaking.
In 2015, director Colin Trevorrow picked up the reins with Jurassic World. That film introduced a whole new set of characters who were contending with a whole new set of renegade dinosaurs. And that one, too, was hugely successful.
Spanish director J.A. Bayona, who directed A Monster Calls and The Impossible, takes over for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. It's the sequel to the reboot.
Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard are back, and so, obviously, are all those dinosaurs, which are causing as much trouble as ever. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. On this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, we're talking about the big anniversary, the new film, and why Jeff Goldblum should be in as many movies as possible. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair is film critic and writer and dinosaur enthusiast and our friend, Chris Klimek. Hi, Chris.
Life finds a way.
So let me say first, I really, really hated the 2015 Jurassic World and decided that the least productive thing I could do was go to this and probably repeat those same points. So I decided I would watch the original Jurassic Park again for my own amusement, which I did. And you guys went to enjoy the new one. And I'm dying to hear about it. Glenn, what did you think of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom?
I liked it better than Jurassic World, but that's a pretty low bar to clear. We should say a word about the plot. On the island where all them dinosaurs are, a volcano blows up. That's the plot, at least in the first half of the film. And so the question this film asks is, what is to be done about these imperiled, ravenous, rampaging, giant murder snakes with legs? And if you ask me that question, I have a ready answer.
Yeah.
Movie's over in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But, inasmuch as the film tries to make this an actual debate, it kind of just doesn't get off the starting block for me, but it is less randomly mean-spirited than the first one. I think that has to do a lot with the genre shift that happens about the midway point. We'll talk more about that. It is more stylish. You can feel a director. You can feel a cinematographer came into play. Yet, there is not a beat in this movie that you don't see coming. Scene by scene, you know exactly what's going to happen. And I sat there resenting it until I realized I was listening to the people around me. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
The whole point of these kind of films is, oh, what are you doing going into that cage, you idiot? Oh, and then you wait for the execution, in many cases,
literal.
The execution. And that predictability engenders a kind of satisfaction that I'm not wired to experience because I see a lot more films than most people do. So I just get impatient. But a lot of people feel that this film's going to make a lot of money. It's not for me. Doesn't need to be.
Yeah. All right. Chris Klimek, give me your bottom line on this film.
Well, this movie for me is a 5.6. At the drive-in, it would be a 9. With a bunch of drunk people, it would be a 9.
But don't drive to the drive-in drunk.
Oh. That's, of course, not. And you're actually not allowed to bring booze into the drive-in, so
all
you
right.
have to be sneaky there. But you used to apply the recliner theater multiplier to movies.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm going to give this one the drive-in multiplier. 9 at the drive-in, 5 at a regular theater.
Yeah, okay. Stephen, you were telling me, as we were chatting before we taped, that you liked this one better than Jurassic World, the one that I notoriously did not like.
Yeah, I mean, to use a different star rating, I felt like the 2015 movie is a 2-star movie, and this is a solid 3-star movie.
Uh-huh.
They clearly took notes on the 2015 movie, which you'll recall made something like $1.6 billion
yeah.
worldwide.
So they were trying to figure out how to get it right this time.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because my fear going in is what incentive do they have to make a better movie? But they clearly went through and they checked all the boxes. They said, why did this movie make Chris Pratt unlikable? They make him more likable. They move him about 2 scotches closer to Peter Quill
mm-hmm.
and away from, well,
he not, smiles a
to unintentionally rhyme, away from being a pill.
Mm-hmm.
The Bryce Dallas Howard character, who Linda, to me, famously referred to as having, quote, the blunt cut bob of mean women,
mm-hmm.
they just make her more of like a dewy-eyed caretaker and less of just a nasty corporate monster. So they've kind of just redefined these characters. As you alluded to, Glenn, they have gotten rid of this weird sadism mm-hmm. in some of the action that kept taking me out of the previous movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the action set pieces were really stylish and exciting, though predictable, as you said, Glenn. I think the script is just boilerplate, just note by note by note. There is nothing particularly interesting that happens in this movie. But as you said, Chris, with, in my case, the recliner theater multiplier, the air conditioning multiplier. I saw this movie on a very hot day. It's fun. This is what I think of when we talk about summer movie season. This, to me, is like a kind of just right, just average, kind of three-star summer blockbuster with a whole bunch of dinosaurs stomping around.
Yeah. Well, so let me point out one thing about what all of you have said here. None of you have said it's really fun and exciting to look at the dinosaurs, particularly. And the interesting thing is, of course, the original Jurassic Park, 1993, watched by me yesterday, so I'm full of thoughts.
And half by me, because I watched up to the T-Rex attack right before bed.
Yeah. So, originally in 1993, one of the big things, if not the big thing about this film when it was being marketed and when it was being reviewed, was how exciting it was to look at the dinosaur technology, right? Both, I would say, the animatronic dinosaurs, which I think still look great.
Yeah, the great Stan Winston, who made the big T-Rex puppet, the full-size.
Amazing stuff. The T-Rex is remarkable. But then also, it was also saluted for its sort of animated, the famous flock of whatever they are. I will call it the Ostrichosaurus. When the Ostrichosauruses are running across, famously chasing the family, not the family, but the guy and the two kids, if you look at that now, even on a computer-sized screen, it looks real cheap.
I think it looks all right. And I mean, and I consider that Phil Tippett, who was a stop-motion guy, who did the AT-ATs in Empire Strikes Back, and who did the Ed 209 in RoboCop and all these famous movie puppets, had to learn a whole new emerging technology. They did not know that they were going to do CGI when they put the movie into production. You know, that was proven in production. So they shifted the workload over to this new tech.
And I'm not faulting what it was at the time. I'm saying, because of the natural evolution of effects, and I think this is true with almost any effect, that when you look at it later, it doesn't have the advantage of being something that you've never seen before, something that looks really cool, something that wasn't previously possible.
But you also have an audience, for the older audience that feels nostalgic for the first Jurassic Park, you still have the sense memory of what it was like when that first movie came out. And I had this experience, I was 20, 21 when the first movie came out, of feeling like, I get to see what dinosaurs looked like?
Yeah.
That excitement and seeing that stuff for the first time, the excitement of seeing that eye in the side mirror of the car for the first time, a lot of the iconography associated with these movies, especially with that first movie, that's deeply imprinted.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, these films, starting with the first Jurassic Park, it's pointless to accuse Steven Spielberg of emotional manipulation, right? Because that's like saying, the thing I don't like about peanut butter is that it's delicious. You always start off with the Brontosaurus, which is the sweep and the strings go, and it's all, you know, mystery and wonder and awe, total Spielberg. And then you get terror and death and screaming, but not a lot of gore. Because we keep it PG, PG-13, so it's not, you don't actually have to contend with actual, like, consequences of what would happen. You just kind of see, like, things happening, rustling, and occasionally you get, at the big climactic moment, you get, like, a little money shot of gore, but that's not what it's about. And it wants to have its dinosaur cake and eat its dinosaur cake at the same time.
I don't think there's such a thing as dinosaur cake, but I will say.
Oh, there must be.
When I, 5-year-old birthday parties. Notwithstanding. So I think the other thing about these films that occurred to me when I watched the first one is, you know, you have a whole setup that is very Spielbergian in a totally different way from how creature stuff is and kind of sci-fi stuff is, which is the wonder part of it. And I think that's been the thing that's been really difficult to duplicate after that. Because if you watch the opening scenes there, when you have Sam Neill, Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum, and the two kids, when you have them coming to the island, there are these scenes that are just them being amazed at how beautiful and remarkable it is to see these animals that they never thought they would see in their lifetimes. And in a way, it's masterful how that is a more wonder-filled encounter for them than it would be for them to see space monsters or, you know, something that's fictional that doesn't exist. To see something that is real but that they never expected that they'd be able to see is filled with wonder. And now, and I think we talked about this during the summer movie preview, now you're in this position of like, why do people keep going
Yeah. Well, and I did think the one thing that I would credit Jurassic World for doing is it does kind of put that question of how do we make it bigger? How do we make it new? How do we thrill an audience that's so jaded and so sophisticated now? And they put that into the movie. Bryce Dallas Howard basically has that as a monologue, you know, where she's in charge of keeping the attendance up at this park.
Right, so we have which to is make why they make scarier. The hybrids. And...
Right, and I mean, that's the smartest thing in the movie, and that's about the only point at which it's kind of smart.
Yeah, and then they make the Amazosaurus or whatever it's called.
Yeah, the Amazosaurus.
Well, I do think it's one of the interesting things about these newer movies is they clearly did sit down and say, we can't just keep building parks that idiots keep coming back to get gored at.
Yeah. Although I gotta say, like, really, what the current era of American life that we're in, I mean, in the 90s, it made a lot more sense to go, like, oh, people wouldn't fall for this, but now I'm like, no, we're so much dumber than we thought we were.
No,
like, but, we would absolutely do this.
But here's what I think. I think the Yelp reviews for Jurassic Park would be like, sometimes, you know, you look at something on Amazon and it's like half fives and half ones.
Yep.
I think half of them would be fives and it'd be like, amazing dinosaurs. My kid loved the Brontosaurus. And then it'd be like, one, my mother was eaten. And
but I do think that these newer movies are taking the Jurassic Park idea and they're now extrapolating that out into a little bit more of, among other things, I would say, an environmental metaphor about basically a man-made evil. Not to say that the dinosaurs are treated as evil, but you have this man-made problem that now must be contended with. And then you have kind of the two camps that are set up in the movie between people who approach that in a humane way and people who approach that in an inhumane way. Guess who gets eaten?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting in these movies how they've developed, and even in the beginning, that the dinosaurs are not a traditional enemy. The goal of the heroes in the movie is not to kill the animals.
Right.
Well, this is, I mean, Spielberg laid it down. Like he always said when he was making the first movie, I want to treat these creatures as animals, not monsters. Now, that is an idea that has gone away as we've had to inflate the stakes and make them bigger and scarier and more cunning to keep them interesting as villains. In this one, at least, there are recurring narrative motifs. In The Lost World, which was the first sequel that Spielberg actually did direct, that they got Goldblum back for, but not the rest of the principal cast, it's pretty much the same as the first half of Fallen Kingdom. So even that's been done.
Yeah.
Right. And as I say, the film switches genres to straight out horror, kind of a haunted house horror, which underscores the fact that, oh, because horror has an implicit, explicit morality to it. Bad people suffer. Bad people die. Yeah. Good people are the ones that eke out a kind of existence at the end, which works. It is a very visually repetitive movie. There's that iconic shot in the first Jurassic Park of the T-Rex roaring as the banner flutters down. We get that over and over and over again for no reason except that it looks cool.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about one other thing from the original Jurassic Park, and that is Jeff Goldblum.
Woo!
Now, part of what makes that movie interesting is that although they go with, like, Laura Dern is a very, you know, she's playing a very straight ahead, like, young woman scientist kind of. I don't think of that as a particularly edge-filled character, nor the Sam Neill character. So then you drop Jeff Goldblum in the middle of it as a kind of like an on-the-make chaos theorist, right?
Yep.
And I think that performance is so much a part of what became his image that he was this very unpredictable, uncategorizable dude who could do a bunch of different things. And you can draw a straight line from the weirdness of him in Jurassic Park. If you continue that and make it kind of bigger and bigger and he gets older and weirder and people get more attached to him, you see, you get to what he was doing in Thor Ragnarok.
Yes. Now, let's do some service journalism. Yes, Jeff Goldblum is in this latest film. He is in this film, I think it's fair to say, fleetingly. Yeah. I mean, he is in...
Totally wasted.
He kind of shows up on the same set. He might change his suit between the two scenes he's in. Like, I think with lunch, he was on set maybe 3 hours.
He really basically could have Skyped into this movie.
I actually thought that was one scene that they was just split up for narrative purposes.
There was two different sets
of testimony scenes.
So let's say that Jeff Goldblum in Thor Ragnarok is a Goldblum 10. In Jurassic Park, he was a Goldblum 6.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park 2, a Goldblum 7. In this film, Goldblum 4.
Yeah.
Almost doing nothing. He's letting his voice slide around those clauses in the way that he does, which makes it so fun to watch, even if he's in it just for a few minutes. But like, we should be honest that a Goldblum 4 is for most other actors like an 8.
Right.
Because he's doing a lot. But man, there's not nearly enough of him.
Yeah.
We need him.
I think if you go back and watch Jurassic Park, the original Jurassic Park, the sex appeal of Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park is a very interesting kind of cinematic moment.
Mm-hmm.
So, Glenn, what do you think? Is there a legacy of Jurassic Park beyond this franchise and special effects? And if there is, what do you think it is?
The legacy is exactly delivering wonder, awe mixed with terror, mm-hmm. but not really scary terror. It's action. It's an action film.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't appreciate the first Jurassic Park because I was, why would I go to the multiplex to see some schlock when I could schlep into Philly and see Derek Jarman's Blue or Orlando? Here's the thing. Jurassic Park, the original one, it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
It turns out it's a pretty good movie.
I enjoyed it even just now.
It does exactly what it wants to do. It hits the box. It's hitting it. The sequels haven't for me because the thing that it did was so iconic and well-defined.
Yeah. How about you, Thompson? Where are you legacy-wise?
I mean, I think part of the legacy of these movies is in the iconography of the original and kind of the use of the Spielbergian use of iconography and how quickly in which a single note of a score can conjure a very real place and time and sense of wonder slash horror.
Yeah.
I think that the iconography of this movie is part of why they were able to, 20 plus years later, put out a vastly lesser movie and make $1.6 billion. Mm-hmm. I think it is that whole franchise, going back to the books, that brilliant use of like a visual stamp, mm-hmm. and in the case mm-hmm. of the movies, a sonic stamp, that I think a lot of movies are still trying to duplicate.
I think part of the reason these kinds of movies fare so much better theatrically than they do at home, where you can revisit them, even, you know, even with big TVs and stuff now, where you still have some of that sensory overload quality that you get in the theater, is it's kind of like going to a rock concert and seeing your favorite band, where you are bringing so much enthusiasm in with you that you might not even notice if they're not playing at their full ability. They're kind of phoning it in, and you know, but you close that gap. You supply what's not there, what's not coming at you from the screen or the mm-hmm. stage.
That is a great point. Thank you very much, Chris. So tell us what you think about all things Jurassic related. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Showtime and the acclaimed series, The Affair. This summer, the journey continues in this intimate relationship drama. A fresh start should mean a new beginning, but the past forces everyone to crash back together. Starring Dominic West, Ruth Wilson, Maura Tierney, and Joshua Jackson. Don't miss a new episode of The Affair every Sunday on Showtime. To try a free month, go to Showtime.com and enter code HAPPY. Offer is for first-time subscribers only and expires July 15th. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and also every week. What is making us happy this week? Steven Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
This has been one of the hardest weeks in which to find a silver lining
yeah.
of any week I have encountered since we started doing this show. So I'm going to talk about next week. 1 week from today, I will be kicking Linda and Glenn out of the studio for an NPR music takeover mm-hmm. of Pop Culture Happy Hour, in which I invite a bunch of my buddies from NPR Music, one at a time, to come in and make a case for what is their song of the summer. And so we are going to have pop music and bangers and Rosé Wave and Decadence and Beyoncé and Jay-Z. And they're all going to come together for a fun and silly and music-packed time. So I have decided to focus for the purposes of this segment on the future and yeah. not the horrible, horrible present.
Yeah. Well, so I assume that has also allowed you to be happy this week about all the music that you're listening
yes,
to.
Yes, but I'm keeping my powder dry for next week. I would be talking about Beyoncé and Jay-Z if I were not doing so next week.
But it's all coming up next week. Thank mm-hmm. you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
One thing I haven't waded into in a big way is serialized fiction podcasts with, you know, Welcome to Night Vale accepted. Most of the ones I've tried, and, you know, at me. Go ahead and tell me ones that I should try. But most of them haven't been funny. They take themselves very seriously. Bubble is a new podcast out of Maximum Fun created by Jordan Morris. Now, Jordan Morris is a friend. I'm a fan of Jordan Morris. Mm-hmm. I have been waiting for him to do something that uses his gifts to the max. This is it. It has a science fiction setting in a city under a mysterious bubble that protects its citizens from terrifying monsters who live on the outside of it. The city inside, it looks a lot like any city you could name where there's lots of bougie hipsters trying to get by. It is, however, the most important thing here, really funny. It satirizes the bougie hipsters in a way that you've heard bougie hipsters satirize before, because there's a lot of Showtime shows and Netflix shows and HBO shows that are doing that. But there's a specificity here. These are not the jokes you've heard before. The dialogue is very sharp. It's quick. The characters develop. Just in the two episodes that have landed so far, the two main characters, a badass woman and a schlubby guy, maintain who they are, but they deepen, their relationship changes, it enriches, it's exactly what you want. And the cast, when they're advertising this thing, they tell you everybody who's in it. I prefer to just hang back, because if you've ever listened to a podcast, somebody from your favorite podcast is going to show up as a voice. It's really well acted, it's really well produced, it sounds great. So that is Bubble from Maximum Fun.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Manifest Destiny is a comic book that I think has been published for about 5 years now. It's bi-monthly, so it's not proceeding quite as quickly as it might. Somewhere in the 30s on the issue count now, but I'm a trade paperback guy these days. There are 5 volumes of this available so far. This is written and created by Chris Dingus, who is a TV guy. Among his credits are my beloved and missed Agent Carter TV show, my favorite thing of the Marvel screen diaspora, drawn by Matthew Roberts. This is a historical fiction account of the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Nice.
But there were monsters.
Yeah.
There were carnivorous plants. So they're dealing with all of the expeditionary challenges of starvation and that sort of stuff, plus monsters, plus bizarre species, plus... Plus.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary. It's gross. It's a lot of fun. But the psychology, the characterization in it is very strong. I really like this comic. It is called Manifest Destiny by Chris Dingus and Matthew Roberts.
Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. I, too, am going to talk about a new podcast. I have spoken before about the Tumblr-turned-Twitter feed. This had Oscar buzz.
Ooh, yes.
And it is run by my friend Joe Reed, a great writer, entertainment writer. And Joe has a fascination with the Oscars, to say the least. And one of the things he finds fascinating is going back and remembering films that people were talking up as big Oscar contenders. And then all of a sudden, they just fell out of the universe of anyone even remembering them. So originally, this was just a Tumblr that would be a movie poster, and it would just be, remember this? And so it would be like Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
Ooh, that's the quintessential one. That's my favorite. Perfect. That encapsulates the entire concept.
Captain Corelli's Mandolin is the encapsulating the entire
concept. The title is funny.
Now it is a podcast. It is Joe and also Chris File. They got together, and what they are doing is they are doing a full podcast episode about one movie at a time that had Oscar buzz. The first one out of the gate, Mona Lisa Smile, starring Julia Roberts, but also Julia Stiles, Kirsten Dunst, Jennifer Goodwin, and Maggie Gyllenhaal. And they are going back to try to talk for like an hour about Mona Lisa Smile. Now, this might seem crazy, except here's the brilliant thing. These movies are neither the amazing movies people talk about all the time or the disastrous movies that they talk about all the time. This is a middle tunnel of films that they want to dive in. Why did this have Oscar buzz? Why did nothing come of it? This had Oscar buzz, a new podcast available wherever you get your podcasts from Joe Reed and his co-host Chris File. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can find Chris at C.T. Klimek. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Also, our producer, Alex McCall, at A.W. McCall. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello, Come In, provides our in-and-out music that you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.